Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
The following podcast is a member of the Great Big Owl family.
Hello, and welcome to The Fear, a podcast about the overlap between comedy and horror. My name's Sarah Morgan.
Hello.
Hello.
My guest this episode is Shannon Murray, actress, writer, broadcaster, disability activist, and lawyer. That's a lot of hyphens.
Yeah, I know. I was going for that whole kind of multi-hyphen thing that millennials do, and I'm just packing in as many as I can.
And a model.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's in my past.
Oh, you're a former model.
Yeah, former model.
Can you...
Reformed.
Was that on How to Look Good Naked?
Yeah. I mean, ultimately it was. It started many, many years before that. In 94, I won a modelling competition to find the first disabled model. So a lot of stuff kind of spun out of that. And then, God, years later, Gawk and everybody at How to Look Good Naked wanted to try and get a disabled model into a high street campaign. They picked me and I got into a high street campaign.
Fantastic.
So job done.
Cool. And you weren't naked for that?
No. I mean, I have been naked once in a photo shoot and once on TV.
Please say everything now.
Well, the photo shoot was for a wheelchair, the Millennium, for the year 2000.
And hang on, the wheelchair was called the Millennium.
It was called the Millennium, yeah. Not the Millennium Falcon, sadly, but just the Millennium.
That's just dates so well.
Yeah.
And it's like 2 days later it's going to be dated, isn't
it? Exactly. Yeah. That's it, out the window, lads.
Yeah.
And that was one of those very, you know, chic side-on pictures where you can see a bit of side boob and maybe some thigh and my legs across. So
I love
very
it.
Very discreet. And the other one was... post-Watershed for the BBC in a Stephen Polyakov drama called Friends and Crocodiles. And whacked my baps out for that one.
Did you now?
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. I'm going to go on Mr. Skin immediately.
It's quite mortifying when you see yourself and go, great, thanks for that screen grab, but that really dodgy angle. Thanks.
Oh, God. Are you literally on the internet? Is there?
Yeah. It's and I'm in a pool kind of languishing with another woman in front of our shared partner, who is Damian Lewis.
Holy shit, that is a fun day at the office, right?
Yeah, and that was one of my first roles on TV, so it's quite intimidating.
Okay. I was about to say, God, it must be really scary getting your clothes off in public. And then it's like naked in a hot tub with a threesome with Stephen Lewis. Okay, I think you can get over that. How is it doing
everyone is very sensitive on the day building up to a scene where there might be any nudity. And wardrobe and makeup, wardrobe and makeup are always your best friends on set, but very much kind of on protection mode. And you get a pair of pants that had been dyed in tea to make them flesh coloured.
Wow.
The other actress didn't get any pants because she was kind of diving about a bit, so her bum was coming out of the water. Whereas I'm just kind of languishing in the pool, just relaxing, saying, come in, the water's lovely, or something like that.
Is that your line?
Something along those lines, yeah.
It sounds very artistic.
It was totally artistic. It's Polyakov, come on, it's very artistic. Yeah.
So relevant.
Exactly.
That's fantastic. But I mean, you have been in so, like, such a diverse range of things. You've been everything from like EastEnders to like a Doctor Who spin-off called The Class.
Yeah, and I've done a fair bit of variety.
Richard Curtis film, is that right? You were in about time?
That was a very, very tiny part.
Oh. Well, then fuck that guy.
Yeah, sorry. It was tiny. You know, when they did actually have a wheelchair, you know, a wheelchair user character, that wasn't actually a disabled character, so that was slightly disappointing.
Interesting.
That was in Notting Hill, but, you know, I've made
fun. Is that character not really a wheelchair user in real life? That's the actor, sorry.
Yeah, no, she's not. But that was back in the 90s when you could kind of get away with that, whereas now I think you'd be
still
hard
though
to try and get away with that. Yeah. Though it does still happen, and lots of people kick up saying, it's fine, it's about the acting, not the disability. It's like, yeah, but you're not disabled, so fuck off.
Yeah, it's as with all kind of minority casting. If
yeah, once we've got a level playing field.
To someone who can play everything else.
Yeah. When there's a level playing field and I can go up for all the able-bodied roles, then fine, you can come up for the disabled roles. But while us lot, the disabled actors, are still only getting a few roles a year, then back off.
Has it changed in terms of people, like, necessarily casting you for disabled characters or a character who's a wheelchair user? Like, or do you, you know, has that changed in the last few years, do you think?
In the past, literally 12 to 18 months, it's changed quite dramatically for me. I don't know if that's across the board. But I'm very fortunate that over the years, well, I mean, I'm doing it for 20 years, so I've met a lot of casting directors. So some of them are now putting me up for non-disabled roles.
Right.
And that's been amazing. So the past year I've had three roles that the character wasn't written as disabled.
Right.
And it's only last year is the first time I've had a role where the character has a job. Yeah. Because disabled people don't have jobs. We don't work.
What was the job?
Journalist in EastEnders.
There you go.
Yeah, and since then there's been lawyer in Silent Witness.
Oh yeah.
I'm about to be a teacher in something coming out next year. Well, not a teacher, I'm a school counsellor in something coming out next year. So
what was Naked Lady in Hot Tub? What was her job?
She didn't have a job. It was all very bohemian and artsy. We were just kind of living off the land. We were, you know, we'd gone off grid.
Sure.
Yeah.
Off grid.
Yeah. Off grid with Damien Lewis.
So you have been in like all kinds of different things. I know you from us working together on a Radio 4 comedy. You do clearly love comedy.
I do. I love it. I don't get the opportunity to do that much. When comedy roles come along for disabled actors, they tend to be really, oh God, sorry people, really badly written and quite cringy.
Are they written like, well, yeah, you tell me how they're written.
It tends to really, they really want to hone in on that, I don't know if there is a name for this technique, but where you've got like a disabled person getting one over on a non-disabled person.
Okay.
And that's just so tired. Yeah.
So that's slightly magical role.
Yeah, and then sometimes everything seems a little bit like, remember like when Dom Jolly was at his peak? It's all got a little bit of a taste of that. And just really cringy.
I think that's really interesting though. It's a really eggy thing of like, not writing an interesting character because the thing about the character is a wheelchair user and they're a prop to make some other character feel uncomfortable.
Exactly.
Or, oh, God,
whereas
it's
so much better if you just don't focus on the disability.
Write a character
and then see what comes out of it.
Yeah.
And as you're on set, maybe prepare to just play with it a bit as the random stuff that might then grow out of that. Somebody going, well, actually, you know, you'd do this or you'd say this.
Yeah, it's thankless enough being a female character in a comedy a lot of time anyway, which is normally some kind of, you know, sexy lamp, as they say, it's a sort of bag of sand with eyes drawn on it who motivates someone to go and do a thing or tells them to, you know, get off their Xboxes and
it's always like the stern mom. Right, so the comedy that actually is very funny about disability, it's called Life on Wheels, and it's a comedy documenting the life of Barry Wright, a wheelchair user from Essex, who, along various side hustles, manages the local six-a-side football team called the Harlow Rifles. If anybody wants to check it out, it is genuinely hilarious.
Awesome.
And the best use of disability in comedy I've ever seen.
Interesting.
Genuinely funny.
That sounds, I'll check it out. Like to talk about your choices and start with what you were scared of as a child, because you had a really interesting childhood.
I did.
You had, your father was Frank Murray, the manager of the Pogues.
Yeah.
Would you mind telling me a bit about him? Because he sounds absolutely fascinating.
He was, I guess, what you'd call a character. you knew when he walked in the room, a very, very big aura, sounds so naff. But everybody wanted to talk to him, to be with him. He was just a really popular guy. Very charismatic, very funny, and very kind. He grew up in Dublin, and he went to school with Philip Lynott. They were best friends. And Dad started roadieing with Philip when he first started gigging. Ultimately went on to be tour manager with Thin Lizzy, touring the world. That was a large, like a lot of my early memories in childhood are kind of from that.
Oh, it's like what?
Being at sound checks, messing around with microphones.
Amazing.
Hanging out with Philip or Scott Gorham. Then Dad went on to be tour manager for Elton John in the late 70s. So there are bits and pieces of that that I remember. Yeah, so many random things, like, you know, getting picked up from school and, you know, wanting to just like rush home and watch either, you know, D'Artagnan or Great and Chill. But it was like, no, you've got to go to a rehearsal room or a sound check or a studio and you're kind of sitting there sulking. Whereas to most people, that's amazing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because I'm sitting there going, for fuck's sake, I'm missing Great and Chill.
Did you feel like it was a normal childhood or did you sort of know that it was unusual?
I knew it was unusual once I went to primary school. Mm. Before primary school, I didn't because most of my mates came from similar backgrounds. Mm. So, like, all our family friends were either, you know, in arts or creative or lots of actors, lots of musicians. Mm. So that, to me, was normal. And, you know, all the kind of the lifestyle that comes with that. Maybe necessarily seeing things you shouldn't really be seeing as a child.
Interesting.
And then I went to primary school.
I don't know, can we go back?
It was the 70s and 80s. Uh-huh. And
so a lot of Lamborghinis.
Yeah, lots of Lamborghinis.
A lot of Dayglow clothing. Yeah,
exactly.
I won't press you for details. I can imagine. I can use my imagination.
You can
use your imagination.
You can imagine. And like being backstage at gigs, you know, I hung out with my parents and adults a lot as a child. I was an only child till I was six.
Okay.
So I went everywhere with them.
What did your mum do?
My mum made stage clothes. So she made a lot of the shirts for Thin Lizzy.
Yeah.
And then when Dad later managed Kirsty MacColl.
Oh, my goodness.
And the Pogues, he was with, he was doing a lot of work with Stiff Records, which at that time were managing, well, were representing a lot of other acts. So you've got, you know, Madness. Dad was also tour manager for the Specials. And mum would make clothes for different people over the years. I think the most fun was when she was doing clothes for Dusty Springfield for a while in the early 80s. So yeah, that was pretty epic.
Did you get to hang out with Dusty Springfield?
I did, yes.
How is Dusty Springfield?
She's everything you want her to be, kind of husky voiced, just brilliant, really.
Oh, amazing.
So yeah, it was pretty crazy. But it was when I went to primary school and I kind of realised, you know, everybody else's parents were wearing, you know, mum's in flowery, long flowery skirts or and dad's in normal things. So my mum and dad would rock up in jeans and cowboy boots.
Mm.
And my dad used to take the piss out of me always saying, you know, can you not just wear normal clothes to pick me up from school? Or we'd have like, there was a brilliant roadie who was a really good friend of mum and dad, big Scottish blonde guy called Charlie McLennan, who women loved. At one point, I remember mum being in New York and coming back with the story that she was sitting on a sofa with Faye Dunaway. And Faye Dunaway was like, who is he? I need you to introduce me to him.
Wow.
But, you know, everybody, you know, you'd see Charlie from a distance and he'd turn up in this big tour van outside the school and do a big whistle and be like, yo. And all the other parents would turn around and we'd be like, yeah, okay, we're getting picked up now.
Oh, amazing. I mean, your dad sounds awesome. I mean, I read a sort of write-up of his funeral, because he passed a couple of years ago, as
he
said, in the great rock and roll call of 2016.
2016.
That is a beautiful line from your eulogy.
Which I wrote at 2 a.m. the day before his funeral, freaking out.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, he died 2 days before Christmas in Dublin.
Sorry.
Thank you. But, you know, trying to organise a funeral and a wake for about 1,000 people between Christmas and New Year in a country you don't live in is... You know, it was pretty much like organising a tour. So all the years of, like, helping out mum or, you know, dealing with itineraries. Back in the day when there wasn't mobile phones, so you knew maitre d's at restaurants and managers of bars, or you knew hotels that when you were going around the rooms trying to track someone down, that you'd be like, put me through to the bar,
Oh, like trying to dredge up celebrities. Yeah.
Well, no, it also, when the, I was trying to look at my dad just for a chat, if I was bored, like, where is he today? Oh, he's in Sweden.
Oh, my God.
What hotel? Let me look it up. So all that came into practice when I had to do his funeral.
Holy moly. But your eulogy is beautiful, I read.
Thank you.
I can't imagine how that's an intimidating crowd to play to. It's a bit lot of.
Yeah, I remember me and my brothers when we were standing up at the steps of the church, and you it's the first time you turn around and you see everyone in the church because your back is to everybody. And it was being live streamed.
Internet,
yeah.
That's modern.
I know. When the church was like, oh, yeah, no, you can have the live streaming. And I was like, that's disgusting. That's disgraceful. Mm-hmm. Who wants to do that? And then on the morning, I was like, oh, fuck it. He'd have loved it. So I put it up on Facebook. And so many of his friends in the States, in Australia, all over the place were absolutely overjoyed that they could watch.
Oh, my God.
And it just hadn't crossed my mind. I thought it was kind of perverse. But looking back now, actually, it was brilliant. Me and my brother, after we'd seen Dad after he died, we went to see him at the mortuary. And we were saying goodbye to him. We nudged each other afterwards going, did you want to take a picture? I was like, yeah, I was tempted. I did think about it, but I thought it's not the kind of picture you're going to want to look back on. But we did. We were both like, you kind of want to take, no, not appropriate.
Selfie with your dad.
Exactly.
I mean, I get it.
I'm kind of like, not sure it's one you're going to want to look back on, but there was a moment of just,
Oh my goodness. I mean, it sounds like in your childhood you confronted so many things that people would find absolutely terrifying. Your life was full of things that would have been like terrifying to most people, and they were like so normal to you, like being on stage or, being in show business and like seeing sex and drugs and all that kind of stuff. So you sound like you probably have a very, and then of course you hadn't your accident when you were 14,
that right? That's right,
yeah. I mean, do you mind talking about
that? No, not at all. I mean, I was a little bit of a mini adult.
Sounds like a very bit saffy from our
Very much so. So, I wasn't one of those teenagers that went off the rails and did loads of experimentation because I'd grown up around it, so there was no allure. And my parents were pretty relaxed, and I was always very honest with them. So if I had questions about, sex, drugs or rock and roll, I could always ask. And so I didn't feel like I had anything to rebel against. Whereas like when some of my teenage mates would be like, oh, we're going off to do this, that or the other. I was like, yeah, whatever. I'd go along, but I didn't feel like I needed to partake rebel. Yeah, it didn't thrill me.
Interesting.
And when everybody else was like, falling for musicians or finding musicians deeply sexy, I was like, no, you mad. They're assholes. And then I had my accident on holiday when I was 14. My grandmother lived in the Canary Islands, so we used to spend every summer there. And it was just day at the beach. I was diving off rocks into the sea and I got unlucky. I hit my head on rocks and I broke my neck and I was instantly paralyzed from the chest down.
Jesus, I'm so sorry.
And then everything kind of goes into high speed, bounced around a couple of different hospitals, and then ultimately ends up in the spinal unit at Stoke Mandeville, and was there for 10 months in rehab. I some people go, oh, didn't you have some kind of big mental breakdown? And I didn't. It was just like, I've got to get on with this. You take it day by day, some days hour by hour, minute by minute. And I had such amazing support from mum and dad and my brothers and friends and family. And I was just determined to get back on with life. Not in a, this isn't going to stop me kind of way. I knew things were going to be different. But I think it's about having like a fire in your belly. I remember I found an old school report and one of my teachers wrote, I was 11 years old, and he was like, she has an incredible zest for life. And I think it kind of goes back to that. It's having a zest for life or a fire in your belly or whatever it is that's just like, I'm gonna keep on going, keep on trucking, whatever. It did obviously help along the way that because of mum and dad's backgrounds, there were perks along the way. So things like going to concerts when they were still not accessible, I'd just get picked up and carried backstage. Now that's not going to happen to everyone else. Or skipping lines at nightclubs and all those kind of things. And then realizing that by being the only person in a wheelchair in the room, it kind of worked two ways. You either got blanked, which was shit, or you got an insane amount of attention. And I learned to kind of like the attention. As long as I was feeling good about myself,
yeah.
I learned to like the attention.
That's interesting. Because you already had that sort of the background of being different and yeah. raised with a sort of very unusual background and very sort of, presumed very confident and very...
I don't know if I was confident. Mm. I think, oddly, I became more confident after the accident.
Interesting.
I was, you know, at school... You know, I had a good group of mates, but I was taller than everybody else, skinnier than everybody else, goofy. And then just around the time I had my accident, I was just on the turn. So my braces had started to work. I was starting to feel more comfortable with my body. I didn't feel quite so skinny. And then I had my accident. I was like, shit. Timing. I was just gearing up for my first snog. Thanks. Oddly, the confidence, I think I was much more confident after my accident.
Interesting.
Because I felt like I had to be.
Mm. This is a funny thing, earlier when we were, because we've been emailing loads about doing the show before, because you listen, which is
amazing. I do listen, I love.
And I loved it when you said, I find it interesting that some people after a trauma go all fearless adrenaline junkie, throwing themselves out of airplanes. I can see where they're coming from, but I also see how fragile life is too. Diving off rocks is what landed me in the chair, so I'm in no rush to do it again.
Yeah.
That seems very sensible to me.
Well, it's like, I think there's still part of me that goes, oh God, what would it be like to like jump out of a plane and have a parachute? But the other part of me goes, that could go fucking wrong and you could end up paralysed from the neck down or dead or brain damaged. Like, be thankful for what you've got.
Is it kind of exhausting to always be expected to be like, yes, seize the day?
A little bit. I mean, there's so much of it. I see there's like a burgeoning market on Instagram with some disabled folk who are really like, you know, whipping up some inspiration porn.
Inspo quotes.
Yeah, the quotes are there. And every single time there's another picture of them in their chair, it has to have some big, huge, elaborate quote underneath it. And I just think, come on, get real. There are some shit days. It's okay to say there are some shit days. But in the same context, you don't need to cry and then put your shit days on Instagram too. Like, I don't know. There's so much self-exposure. And I think people need to keep a little bit of themselves for themselves.
Yeah, it's exhausting. Yeah. I completely agree. I think there needs to be something that's yours.
Yeah, and I think also it is still being done to get the likes. You know, back on Facebook when it used to be like, you okay, hun?
Yeah.
And now Instagram's equivalent is somebody having a shit day but putting up a really gorgeous picture of themselves with some big dramatic quote.
Yeah, maybe wearing a Korean face mask and going, self-care.
Yeah, do you know what I mean? Or like, you know, quoting, is it Leonard Cohen, you know, the darkness, you have to have the light, that's where the light gets in or some shit. That one's getting used a lot. But yeah, in that kind of... the disability genre, shall we say, on Instagram. There are a lot of people who... But then it's... What it does is it does provide, you know, inspiration for non-disabled people who then are like, oh, well, I'm having a shit time, but look, she's in a wheelchair and my life must be better. And I'm like, do you know what? Fuck off.
Yeah.
You know, don't assume because somebody's in a wheelchair their life is worse than yours.
Yeah.
You know, that's demeaning, it's patronising. And it's, you know, I don't have this conversation so much anymore, but I did used to have it. I think people are slightly more woke now. But when they'd say, you know, why are you in a wheelchair? What happened? And like, God, I'd kill myself if that happened to me. Well, maybe you would, Jack. I don't think you can handle
it. Hang on, sorry. People have said that to you?
Oh, yeah.
They should kill themselves. Yeah.
Like, well, if you haven't got the balls to handle it, that's not my problem.
Yeah, essentially what they've said to you is, hi, I'm a massive coward and massively self-absorbed.
Totally.
Fucking hell.
And my life is so shallow that if I couldn't walk, it would be over. It's like, really, walking is not the be-all and end-all.
Jeez, I just can't believe, God, people.
But I think that taps into people's own fears about disability and being in a wheelchair.
Yeah, this is something we were talking about in email, and I loved your, you said, we were talking about people's fear of disability, and you said that, you know, you try and be understanding and you get where people are coming from and all that kind of stuff. And then you signed off the email with, I think it explains a lot of the odd behaviour and narrow ways of thinking. Well, that and some people are just cunts.
Well, yeah, there is that.
My mate bought a toaster. We go through celebrities' Amazon purchase histories so you don't have to. Keep calm and love Dom Jolly novelty keyring and fridge magnets.
Yeah, I love that.
The G-spot.
The good vibrations, guys.
green dot laser sight rifle gun scope.
I've bought that quite a lot of times, I think.
Right, okay. The Sex Doctor's Guide to Keeping It Hot.
Ah, oh, interesting.
Did another child come along 9 months later?
Yeah.
Loads of great eps up now, and new ones dropping every Monday. That's My Mate Bought a Toaster from Great Big Al.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
As a kid, I think I remember the first time I ever saw a Hammer horror. Mm. I think I'd snuck out of bed because I can remember watching it from behind a sofa, and I thought I was mesmerised, much in the way that women are by Dracula when he starts doing whatever he does with his eyes.
What is that, though? Why do women love Dracula so much?
I don't know. I honestly don't know, but I remember as a kid, like, watching the Hammer horror going, oh, hello, what's happening here? And it was a mixture of, like, fear and this guy in a cloak.
Mm.
Like, I don't have a vampire fantasy now. I don't want to be with, like, some big goth that wants to bite me.
God, I do. I think that's my type now.
There you go. Yeah. Electric ballroom is your place.
Cyber dog.
Yeah, exactly. And then Tales of the Unexpected. It was like, it was scary, but you could sneak out of bed to watch it without it being, like, petrifying. And even just the music used to be like, oh, that's a bit creepy.
And a bit the sort of naked lady dancing thing was quite, it was on that edge of, like, sexy scary, like Dracula. Yeah.
You knew you were up late watching something you possibly shouldn't be watching.
Yeah, she was looking a naked lady in a catsuit.
Exactly.
Dancing in a fire. Scary. Yeah.
A bit like some of the James Bond intros.
Yes.
But there was one episode that stands out because it ended with somebody getting locked in a sauna.
Yeah.
And getting hotter and hotter. And then I think it just ended. The person didn't get out. Like, they were clearly going to die in the sauna. And that has left me with such a fear of being locked in saunas. So I can't go in them alone. And if I do, I feel like I need to leave the door open a little bit. I mean, I'm not good in saunas anyway. I'm never going to be in it for longer than 3 or 4 minutes. Mm. But it terrifies me.
I would like to meet the person who, when they get in a sauna, doesn't slightly think, what if the door locked behind me and I was trapped in here forever? Because that person is who I'm frightened of.
Yeah.
Surely everyone...
What kind of confidence is that?
Is
invincible.
It's the patriarchy.
Yeah.
The patriarchy.
It's the patriarchy.
One of the many facets of the patriarchy is they will go in a sauna and not immediately think, what if someone locked this behind me and I was trapped in there and boiled forever?
Exactly.
Because I think that's completely...
They're terrifying. Yeah.
They're not terrifying. I mean, they're wonderful.
See, I prefer a steam room now.
Oh, I prefer a steam, yeah.
Much prefer a steam
room.
Yeah,
a bit of wet steam.
Yeah.
A bit of wet heat.
Yeah,
wet heat. I like the smell of a sauna.
Yeah, that woody smell.
Yeah,
it's nice.
I feel like people talk less in steam rooms because of the visibility, I think.
Yeah, true.
But they always get a bit chatty in the sauna. Can't be asked.
I've been in people's houses that have saunas. Still
living your best life, babes. Yeah.
One was an old school friend. They had a sauna in their house. I remember we used it once for Spin the Bottle. And then I'm sure my uncle had one in his house in Dublin. Mm. Yeah.
Well, I looked up this Tales of the Unexpected. Because I'd not come across it.
I didn't make it up, I promise, because somebody else on Twitter remembers it.
I Googled, and all I could put in, Tales of the Unexpected,
trapped in sauna, and all I found was a website of people discussing this episode of Tales of the Unexpected being a missing one, because they reckon that you see Prunella Scales' boobs in it. Prunella Scales from Fawlty Towers.
Oh my
they
God.
Reckon that it's her sauna and she gets her baps out in it. And I now realise, I think it's probably the same website that if anyone wants to see, that you probably screen grabbed on.
Brilliant. So I'm with Prunella.
Tellyboobs.com or whatever it's called.
I'm in good company if I'm with Prunella.
It was some very thirsty men or women. Who knows? All going like, "Oh, you get to see fucking Sybil's tits in a sauna." And I read that and I was like, I'm not going to delve any further.
Yeah, that's enough.
I'll probably see it at some
point. God, I don't remember that bit at all. I just remember the sauna and being
locked
in.
It might not have happened. Yeah, we'll never know.
This is true.
Sybil's tits might just be something that the fever dream of a Roald Dahl fan. Well,
I love how specific that was.
I've imagined a thing, guys.
That's it.
Does it exist? And if not, can someone draw me a picture of it?
Sybil in a sauna.
Brilliant. Oh, you also mentioned the London's burning.
Fuck yeah, that was some scary shit as a kid.
Okay.
I found, so I think anything that was on a Sunday night that ended a bit dark, that was gonna, that's a downer automatically. Yeah. But I can remember watching London's Burning as a kid, and I'll be, you know, all about watching drama, great.
Mm.
But some seriously horrifically sad endings, because obviously it's about fire. But as a kid, it freaked me out so much that when it would finish, I think it was partly I had the fear that I hadn't actually finished my homework.
Oh, it's that Sunday, yes.
It's that Sunday night thing. And then if you hear the Spitting Image theme tune, you knew you were really up shit creek.
Oh, God, yes.
And then if you heard the South Bank show, you were like, I'm fucked, I still haven't done my homework.
You lived such a rock and roll life getting to the South Bank show. But that Sunday afternoon decline towards school.
It like Poirot.
Started Antiques Roadshow, Lust of the Summer Wine. Yeah. And then it was just, it was that steady roll.
What was that drama about the two sisters that made the clothes in the 20s?
Oh, fucking hell, The House of Elliot.
Yeah, that was another one. That was all just Sunday night alarms.
It just, your skin got smaller and smaller on your body as you knew that it was coming.
Exactly.
Oh, God.
Yeah. But after London's Burning, I then would sit upstairs in my bedroom and figure out, if I woke up and there was a fire in the house, what would our escape route be? And my room was nearest the bathroom, so I'd be like, well, I'd go in, I'd wet some towels, I'd run into my brother's bedrooms, I'd get them up. If we couldn't get downstairs, I'd get them out the window. And then I'd like go downstairs, get mum and dad. I had this entire plan. I used to run around like doing it. And that was London's Burning. Put the shit of fear into me.
I missed London's Burning. And it ran for like forever. And I was like, it was someone's job, presumably a team of writers' job, to think of new ways of doing fire.
Yeah.
I mean, it had to be like human drama as well. But it was like, ultimately, there was going to be a fire.
Yeah, because the initial one, it was initial one-off drama that was written by Jack Rosenthal.
Oh.
And then I don't think the series was written for him, but the initial one was.
Mm.
But God, it was a hard watch.
Yeah.
I should never have been watching that.
Let's talk about your favourite scary moment from film or TV.
Yes.
You said a lot of different films, but the one I wanted to pinpoint down and talk to you about was Poltergeist.
Yes.
I rewatched this for this. I watched,
rewatched
it last night. It's such a great film. Is there a particular moment that stood out for you?
There's a few. I mean, obviously, there's the classic when Carol Ann says, "They're here."
Oh, the timing of it.
Which is just perfection.
It's probably been like a good 10, 15 years since I've watched it, maybe even longer than that. And I just I'd never got how cool the parents are.
Yeah.
Because they're smoking weed.
They're just smoking,
they're making
back.
Each other laugh.
Exactly. They were a brilliant couple.
The mum's like, "Can you put yourselves to bed? I'm just going to go and lie in the bath." Like, they're really fun. Like, you really root for them. And it sort of opens with this like group of like rowdy dads all drinking, like shaking up beer cans.
Yeah.
And the mum says, "Shit," I think is the first word she says. And then picks up the dead dead canary that triggers the whole thing off.
Yeah, exactly. You know something's not quite right. This is not E.T.
It's the canary in the coal mine.
Yeah.
the dead canary that they bury in the back garden on, spoiler alert, turns out to be... It's not a Native American burial ground, is it? It's just an old burial ground.
Yeah, it's an old burial ground.
And it's just that the metaphor of the film is... Yeah. You know, we literally start with the national anthem. And
exactly,
then
here's
some
perfect Americana.
Perfect Americana.
And here's what you fucked over.
Here's what you've paved your perfect Americana on top of, which is Native American...
Yeah. Burial ground, and what is it? You moved the headstones, but you didn't move the bodies. And I was just freaking out with the developer. You just moved the headstones.
I love a willfully ignorant man in a suit in a Spielberg film.
And then everything just kind of erupting with gravestones and bodies.
Oh, that bit when they all come shooting out of the ground is so great.
So I think my two big moments in it are when the mum is outside scrambling around and falls in the pool, and then all the skeletons start popping out.
They were real skeletons as well.
That's horrific.
Apparently they didn't tell her until afterwards. They shot all that, and then it's like it was cheaper to get real human skeletons than get fake ones. I know, right?
Oh God, I feel itchy. And there was that, and then the fact also that I love in the film is, you know, Zelda, who plays
Rubenstein,
The Exorcist, and she's like, you know, this house is clean, but it's not, because they come back. So you think you've got your tidy ending.
What happens to Zelda Rubenstein's character? I guess she must. Yeah,
well, she comes back for Poltergeist 2,
which I have not seen. There's so many bits in it that I can't. I don't know if they were just they were a trope at the time, like clowns are scary, or if that film invented the trope of clowns being scary, of little girls whispering sinister, vague statements. They're here.
Oh, I love it. I mean that, and then the kind of when you're in a bedroom and something's freaking you out, and you know the only place left to look is under the bed. Like you've looked around the room, the doll is nowhere to be seen. It's got to be under the bed. So you look under both sides of the bed, not there. Boom, it's right behind you. Like I'm such a sucker for jump scares. I leap, I scream. Or the one where somebody's looking in a bathroom cabinet, nothing there. They open the cabinet, get the pills, close the cabinet, and the boogeyman's behind them.
I mean, this film as well got one of the best bathroom mirror scenes of all time, which I think when I saw it as a kid, it is so outrageous. Like in a film that I think was a PG when I was a kid, and they've ramped it up a little bit to 15 now, which doesn't normally goes the other way around. Yeah. I'm sure it was a PG when I was a kid, which meant it was like a family horror film. And the scene, the man just literally peels his whole face off and rips his jaw off, and it all goes in the sink. And
gruesome.
It's the most...
So gruesome.
It's so appalling that I think I probably laugh.
Yeah.
And then I never knew what the... beast, the monster beast ever looked like, because I always close my eyes. I think actually maybe watching it last night was the first time I ever saw what the actual beast looked like. Not a great special effect. Like something from the Neverending Story or something.
I close my eyes definitely. Like the things that scare me most in horror movies, I can watch the gory stuff, but anything that's got like a religious connotation or a paranormal thing, I lose my fucking shit. I can't handle it.
Yeah. Well, you told me that you went to Catholic school.
Yeah,
right?
Well, I went to Catholic primary school.
Yeah.
And I think it comes from that.
But
you know, we used to have a babysitter come over, and I'd just be like, tell me all the scary stories. And then I'd tell them to other people at sleepovers, and then we'd all have scary stories. And some of it would be based off who'd seen a horror movie.
Right.
And we'd be talking about, like, you know, it was always people who had older brothers or sisters who'd let you stay up. So you'd had, like, you know, the first person that had seen Halloween or anything with Freddy, Jason or Michael was always, you know, guaranteed to get a reaction. But the scary stories, and also then going back home to Ireland as a kid for holidays, there'd always be some kind of folklore. I remember the first time I heard about a banshee scared the shit out of me.
Yeah. But yes, I love the idea of a small bunch of Catholic schoolgirls telling each other ghost stories.
Scaring
in itself, a terrifying image.
Yeah.
Like two girls in their uniforms going like, have you heard the one about the crawling eyeball or whatever? Yeah. Or if you look in a mirror three times and say Bloody Mary, I'm freaking out like imagining
that. The shit we used to make up. And then when there was a school trip, and we made up, somebody had a story about this thing called the bubble baby, and then we all became terrified about this thing called the bubble baby, and we thought we could see the bubble baby on the ceiling staying in a weird German hostelry. Oh God, we used to scare the shit out of myself.
What was the bubble baby?
I can't remember it was just like a large yellow luminous bubble shaped baby. But it was scary for some, I can't remember the details. But it was the bubble baby.
You said you didn't like anything to do with like meddling in dark forces, like supernatural stuff, like Ouija boards.
I'll watch some of it. Yeah, somebody told me a story about a girl that lived up the road, and they'd all been sitting around doing a Ouija board, and they asked it some questions. can't remember what it said. But then it started spelling out the word fire. And they were like, oh, okay, whatever, put it away. And apparently the girl woke up in the middle of the night and the Ouija board was in her bedside cabinet and her bedside cabinet was on fire. Now, obviously, looking back, that was bullshit. But to a 10-year-old, that story, was terrifying.
A 10-year-old at Catholic school being told that Satan is definitely real and if you are bad, you will definitely go to hell. Yeah. You will definitely meet a demon who will definitely set fire to you. Yeah.
And I do believe in ghosts. Oh, God, I sound like the Cowardly Lion.
No, I love
that. I do believe in ghosts.
That was my next question.
Yeah, I do believe in ghosts? Yeah, I haven't seen any.
Okay.
But I believe they exist. So I think that then ties into this. So obviously I'm going to be scared of something I think exists, whereas if I didn't believe them, I wouldn't give a shit.
I don't know. I mean, I think it's really, you know, I'm so ridiculously open-minded at the moment because I really want everything I think about the world to turn out to be wrong, because that would be wonderful. It's like, if it turns out that someone does know more than I do, or that more that the people who think they know things do, then that would be wonderful. So I'm very open-minded. I mean, I'm very into witches at the moment.
I always get into witches around Halloween. Also, I think there is a real push at the minute. On social media, there is so much more stuff about astrology and
and
witching and saging things. Mm. And so I do think that is a bit of a thing. And like, the witchy stuff, I find that interesting.
It gets a little bit Gwyneth Paltrow jade eggs at times, I thought, the witchy stuff, where it's like, buy this crystal.
Exactly. So I've just got to move because my jade eggs. I like to wear them when I'm out and about. No, sorry, that clanking noise. It's rearranging me eggs. All that stuff I find fine. It's just I think it's quite Ouija board specific. Mm. They scare the shit out of me. I think it's that thing of like, if you start contacting spirit, but you don't know if you're contacting a good spirit or a bad spirit, is it malevolent? Is it going to fuck with you? Is it going to possess you and freak you out? And then you'll be like in a film, like, what's that one? The Haunting of Emily Rose or something.
Mm. Oh, right. What's the classic is it The Exorcist?
Yeah, I haven't actually watched The Exorcist because I'm a bit too scared.
It is the best of the scary, of the meddling with dark forces.
I think I might be just scared of the panpipe music.
Yeah, a bit Mike Oldfield.
Yeah.
And isn't that how Richard Branson got rich?
Yeah, it is, isn't it? Yeah.
He worked at Virgin.
Tubular Bells.
He loved Tubular Bells and he put it out as I think he pushed for it to be, an album that no one else cared about.
So we've got him to blame for it.
So basically, if our NHS gets bought by
Virgin,
a bearded cunt, I can't think of a nicer way of putting it. Then we can play in the film The Exorcist. Yeah. That's
like
the
that
real
tie-in.
Horror.
I like that tie-in.
The real horror is not made up fucking goblins. The real horror is that... Richard, does that... I mean, as someone who presumably has quite a lot of vested interest in the NHS...
Yeah, that does not fill me with any joy whatsoever.
It's like we have a segueing beautifully into Fears You Live With Now.
Yes. There are so many.
It was great. I said, tell me about Fear You Live With Now. And you said cockroaches, which we can absolutely talk about. And then you went, but there's loads of other things, but I don't want to be a bummer. And it's like, be a bummer.
I'll do
a bummer, it's sharing.
I mean, I'll do a bit of both. So cockroaches terrify me. I don't know if it's their speed, it's the antennae, it's the fact they can fly. Like, I thought they were horrific anyway. Mm. Then I found out they could fly, and I was like, are you taking the fucking piss? And then one flew into my hair on holiday, and I realised nobody was taking the piss. The fuckers can fly. That was horrific.
Also, they're going to outlive us all.
Yeah.
Quite comforting.
No, nothing in a world overrun by cockroaches.
I'm sorry, I apologise.
I did leave a holiday early because there was a cockroach outside my room, and I freaked out. I was also starting to come down with swine flu. I didn't know that at the time, but subsequently I did realise I had swine flu, so that might have...
Is an unpleasant...
That might have clouded my judgement somewhat. Mm. I don't know. But yeah, I am absolutely fucking terrified of them. They are a fear I live with, particularly on holidays.
Do we have much of them in the UK? Are they?
I've only ever seen one once in a swimming pool in East London.
Oh.
In a changing room, and I got the fuck out of there really quickly and then changed in the corridor.
Jesus.
But no, generally it's a holiday in hot countries. But it's one of the reasons I haven't done like the whole kind of Southeast Asia thing or South America. I do realise I would have to go for some kind of hypnosis treatment. Because I do want to go and visit those countries.
Yeah.
But there will be some...
So it really does... It actually restricts you from...
Yeah. I'm just kind of like, no, that's too scary. They'll be like a foot long. But then on the other side, like the more serious things, oh God. I suppose, like living as a disabled person in the UK, you know, access isn't always great. Treatment isn't always great. I mean, I'm very lucky. There are people much worse off than me. But, the, you know, when you see care home exposés, that's worrying. It's kind of like, well, what if I end up in one when I'm older? And I'm really badly mistreated? Or what if a loved one? I very rarely talk about this, but my mum has early onset Alzheimer's. And we've been living with that for about 6 years. And she's only kind of starting to show more evidence of it and decline because it was caught really early. And the thought of her being mistreated in a care home.
Yeah.
Like, that terrifies me. So I think, you know, that's a big scary one. But also there's a lot of humour that comes with that. You know, I come from a very big Dublin family, always had a very dry, very dark sense of humour. That's what got us through my accident. Mm. And that's the same thing, you know, we apply to mum. We started calling it Ali Z because it's a nicer name than, like, Alzheimer's is such a harsh fucking word. It's such an ugly word. So Ali Z is just a bit lighter and it's shorter for text messages. And you know, I've got two brothers that live in the States, one brother that lives in the UK. And we, you know, we've got our kind of sibling WhatsApp chat like most families. And that's what keeps us, you know, sane and together and pinging stories or photographs or her singing in the car to random 80s tracks that she seems to know the words off by heart for some reason that I don't quite understand.
This is a recent development that she knows.
Yeah, I was in traffic a few weeks ago, really hot sunny day, had the windows down and I've realised that, you know, she'll sing along a lot to Heart 80s, so sometimes I'll put that on.
Nice.
And she's just started singing along to Hadley and Spandau Ballet for Gold, hand actions and everything. And I was like, whoa, I didn't realise you were such a Spandau Ballet fan in the 80s when you were actually hanging out in, like, the limelight or whatever.
Oh, yeah, hang on. She had a whole different life in the 80s that was not that music. It was,
yeah,
like,
no, exactly.
It was all Pogues and
yeah, but I mean, I can remember
Stiff Records, yeah.
It's kind of like thinking back to names that would just get bandied around the house. And it'd be like, you know, I'd see mum getting ready and, like, you know, there'd be a fur coat and makeup and everything and I could smell opium. The perfume, not the drug.
Oh, and but it was kind of a drug. Yeah. I mean, it's the second you said it, I went a bit woozy.
Yeah, I'm straight back. I'm straight back. And but it'd be like, you know, where you have to, oh, down to Steve Strange's. And it's kind of like, now I look back at, like, how radical that was. But that was my parents' lifestyle. You know, I only kind of started to really gatecrash it, I suppose, the late 90s. And I used to blag my dad's Groucho membership. And I had a misspent youth in the Groucho, which makes me sound like a massive fucking wanker, I realise. I can only apologise.
I love the sort of little images. Oh, hang on, how old are you then?
That was from about the age of like 18 to 22, 23.
Amazing.
You know, childhood was spent running around the electric ballroom.
Yeah.
You know, that was my playground. I just sound like a massive dick, I'm sorry.
But it was electric ballroom at that time was just the goth central, wasn't it?
Yeah. But it was where lots of people went for sound checks as well.
Right. Oh, okay.
And rehearsals. And that. And there's a place, John Henry's. There's some different studios. And they were just like the way that I suppose other people's mum and dad would talk about, you know, we're going over to Uncle Roger, you know, or whatever. Yeah. For me, it was all music industry.
Did you ever have a goth phase?
No, fucking hated that shit.
I would move, and this is just a theory, and please correct me if I'm being very patronising or wrong here, but I would imagine if you'd gone through what you went through when you were 14 and then you looked at a bunch of your peers who were fucking moping around because of their mock A-level results in fucking eyeliner and PVC and buffalo boots, I would fucking hate those people.
Yeah. No, my teenage years, after my accident, I couldn't go back to my old school, which was just around the corner in a Victorian building. Yeah. So I went to a sixth form in West London. And I was all about hip hop and R&B.
Nice.
That was me, right. 90s yeah. R&B and hip hop.
That makes a lot more sense. Yeah. Yeah. I want to talk to you both very briefly about your blog.
Yes, which is slightly inactive at the moment because I need to refurb it.
Well, now you've got an excuse.
Yes.
There'll be traffic
pressure.
So much traffic from this podcast.
In their millions.
The clicks.
I'll think of some clickbait.
They'll be swarming. But you wrote a brilliant article
on International Women's Day about intersectionality, which is that you talked about International Women's Day being for all women, brackets, but not you.
Yeah.
And there was a thing you said on there about it sort of not wanting to be the angry disabled person who was ranting about how exclusive, not like limited, but like how uninclusive certain aspects of feminism were on International Women's Day, where everyone was in a little bracket that was women, trans, bi, women of colour, and disabled women weren't included in that.
Yeah.
And it's a really brilliant read.
Thank you.
Yeah. But you about halfway through, you sort of get the fear. You get worried that you sound like an angry, ranting disabled person. Yeah. I'm just going to read a little bit because I think this is brilliant. You put, "Why are people so fearful of anger? Why do we compliment those who suppress their anger and frustration? It's emotion like any other, a response, a reaction, and can be a positive tool to galvanize and motivate people and organizations into action." I mean, I think that's really interesting that you're scared of being seen as an angry person.
I think it's because I feel like I've been told that anger is bad. Mm. It's a bit like when people say to you in an argument, "Oh, the moment you raise your voice, you've lost an argument." Well, the moment you swear, you lost an argument, and I just want to yell, "Well, you fuck off!" Because I don't believe that. I mean, yes, I can argue very articulately when I need to. I'm a trained lawyer, so you know, I can put facts and I can be articulate and I can use really patronising four-syllable words if I have to. But when I'm in the rage, it tends to be quite sweary. Which I think is okay. I don't have a problem with swearing. But there is so much in daily life that can be frustrating, and I pick my battles very, very selectively, because it's exhausting to carry around that much anger. And it's frustrating when people kind of put you in a box. So I think I felt a little bit conflicted with this kind of new wave of feminism, which is amazing, so that, you know, younger girls feel empowered to say no to things, say yes to things, to own themselves. But I kind of felt like that was instilled in me growing up.
Yeah.
And then because I then went through so much later in my teens with my accident and everything, I guess there's part of me that feels a little bit like, oh, come on, get a grip. Like, empower yourselves. Let's just keep moving. So I'm going off on a tangent here.
No.
But with the intersectionality, what was frustrating was when people would say, "Oh, mean all women," and then the event didn't have wheelchair access.
Yeah.
So it's like, I'm trying to buy tickets, I'm trying to be part of this.
Yeah.
But I'm automatically excluded because your event is in some trendy space in East London that has no fucking wheelchair access.
I love your point about, I mean, it's great that we all have safe spaces, but can I go for a wee first?
Yeah, exactly.
That's such a brilliant point.
If you've got space in a building, can you make it a disabled toilet before you make it a safe space? There has to be a kind of category of needs here. And what was hard was, I mean, this was before the word intersectionality became such a buzzword, because I know that it was initially kind of created to be applied to race and disabled people. We know we've hijacked it slightly.
selfish bastards.
Yeah, kind of,
to open
word.
The conversation.
but before everything kind of, God, this was, must have been about 7 or 8 years ago, a couple of people put me forward to a editor of a part of a newspaper saying, "You should get Shannon to write about this," which was lovely. And then the person got in touch and said, "What would you like to write about?" And I didn't know intersectionality as a word. So I was trying to explain how I was starting to feel with all this kind of new feminism that's coming up. And I knew she was a feminist, but no, not interested. Couldn't see it.
Yeah.
And it's like, no, you can't see it because you've got fucking privilege.
Yeah.
So you can't see
that
it.
That particular kind of feminism that is essentially, That thinks all feminism should look like,
should look a particular way,
look exactly like itself.
And the kind of, I'm kind of anti the whole kind of the slut shaming direction that I feel some feminism takes. And it was like, you know, wolf whistle bad. And it's like, well, no, hang on. If you're a disabled woman who has been told your entire life that you are not sexual, you're not sensual, you have no desire, you're essentially invisible to, you know, whatever sexuality you have an affinity with, and then somebody, male or female, gives you a compliment or wolf whistles you, that could make your fucking month. So to then start saying, no, that's really inappropriate, it's kind of like, well, No, there are moments when it's inappropriate, but there are moments when it's going to make someone's day because they felt their entire life like they're invisible and somebody has recognised them as, you know, not just being, you know, really intelligent and like Stephen Hawking, because that's one group of disabled people. Or you've got to be a super athlete. That's another group of disabled people. But some of us are just out here, you know, doing our grind. Yeah. And like anybody else, want to be seen as like, you know, whether it be funny, whether it be sexy, whatever, but recognised as a human being.
Well, yeah, God. Well, the idea of the angry feminist, I think it's the same emotion where it's like if women start getting passionate and articulate.
Exactly. And I think for me, coming from an Irish background and, you know, where everything is very vocal and we do get loud and we are passionate. And then sometimes when I'm with a bunch of very British friends, it can be like, you know, calm down, or, you know, you're really passionate about it, or you're getting really worked up. And it's like, yes, I fucking am.
Yeah.
But I then feel like I must be doing something wrong, or am I this really angry person? And I'm not. I'm just passionate and I'm vocal and I do say what I think. I'm really shit at keeping things in. Really shit at keeping things in.
Thank fucking God. On behalf of your many fans.
Thanks.
Thank you. Shannon Murray, thank you.
Thank you.
Oh, your Instagram handle is Shenanigans.
_Murray.
So that's where people can find you. Shannon Murray, thank you so much for coming on the
Thank
Fear.
You.
Cheers.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.